FM.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday, and it's the Radio Northwest Network. It's my pleasure to be with you. I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails. And yeah, I'm going to be talking about Donald Trump essentially taking over law enforcement in Washington, D.C. And if your first response to that is, how dare the president do that? Well, let me tell you something. The 50 states are assigned most of the job of government. The federal government, in theory, is limited to only the enumerated powers, that is, the things that the Constitution says that the federal government must do. But one of the things the Constitution also does is that the federal government is allowed to have a place where our federal government can be housed for the most part, and that is Washington, D.C. So Washington, D.C. is a creation of the federal government. In fact, for a long time, the federal government actually oversaw the operations of the District of Columbia. Only now, it has its own crazy, lunatic government, including the mayor of Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser, who until recently has been saying, we don't have a crime problem here. I mean, pay no attention to all those bodies and all that blood on the streets. They would not get serious about it. And Trump actually said, you need to take control of this situation, and if you don't, I will. And as of today, he is doing exactly that. In fact, Joel, can we jump into that presser? I don't know if we can or not. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, take a listen.
Subjectivity of that declaration. In fact, the chief has already provided a high-level liaison and point of contact with the federal government and made those initial contacts. The executive order is also clear that the president has delegated his authority to make requests of us to Attorney General Pam Bondi. I have reached out to Attorney General Bondi and hope to schedule a meeting soon. My message to residents is this. We know that access to our democracy is tenuous. That is why you have heard me and many, many Washingtonians before me advocate for full statehood for the District of Columbia.
Baloney.
We are American citizens. Our families go to war. We pay taxes and we uphold the responsibilities of citizenship. And while this action today is unsettling and unprecedented, I can't say that given some of the rhetoric of the past, that we're totally surprised. I can say to D.C. residents that we will continue to operate our government in a way that makes you proud. We will balance our budgets. We will deploy our services. Our kids are going to start school on August 25th. And we will work with the federal government to do the things that they should do for our city.
Yeah, because I'm going to jump out of this at this point. She doesn't have much choice. The federal government gives the D.C. government the authority to do what it does. If the federal government, including President Trump, wants to take that authority away, and the fact is, this woman has been responding by saying, well, crime isn't up, crime is actually down. I'll get into the details of this a bit later, but there's already been one cop suspended earlier this year because he was messing with the statistical numbers that they were releasing to say, no, crime isn't up, crime's actually down. In other words, they've been playing the same kind of numbers game that the Bureau of Labor Statistics had been playing with federal numbers, saying, no, jobs are up during Joe Biden. And then we find out they weren't up, they were actually down by 1.5 million. And then when Trump comes in, oh, jobs, terrible numbers. Fact is, you can play games with numbers. And we all know that over the last 5 years, since the year of the so-called pandemic, that what happened was big cities defunded their police departments. They diminished the number of officers that were actually patrolling on the streets. And the end result of that was, if you don't have many cops out there, it doesn't look like you have much crime, because not many criminals are being caught. Not many crimes are being investigated. But the fact is, Washington, D.C. is a notoriously dangerous place. President Trump gave them fair warning, said either fix the problem yourself or I'll come in and do it. And now he has done just that. He's put additional federal resources on the streets. And I would suspect that if you ask the average D.C. resident, not the people like Muriel Bowser, who have a political dog in the fight, but ask the average person, do you want some of the violent criminals taken off the streets of your city? If you do, raise your hand. I have a feeling you'd see an awful lot of hands. And if they say, well, do you really care who does it, whether it's Muriel Bowser or Donald Trump? I think to the person who's worried about mom or dad getting mugged on the way to the grocery store or getting killed by drug gangs, I have a feeling most of them would say, we don't really care. At this point, President Trump has deployed the National Guard to Washington, D.C. I think the city is going to be better off for it. So, welcome to a Monday. Let me tell you about a couple of things. Number one, our X poll. Should all members of Congress be forced to take and then publicly disclose an IQ test? President Trump today called on lefty firebrand Jasmine Crockett. I mean, if you thought AOC was a dimwit, Jasmine Crockett makes people like AOC look like Stephen Hawking by comparison. Trump says that Jasmine Crockett, member of Congress and member of the Democrat Party from Texas, is dumber than the country destroying morons who are in the House of Representatives so-called squad. You know, all the woke types. And he says they all need to take cognitive exams. Trump has issued an intelligence test challenge last month to Jasmine Crockett of Texas and New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who are members of the squad. He says Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett is a very low IQ individual, much in the mold of AOC, plus three gang of country destroying morons, only slightly dumber. Today's X-Bowl is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, I've got to mention this. One of the people who is an unregistered sex offender because Tina Kotek's government, which has had a couple of years to get it done, decided not to process all those sex offenders. And what does that mean? Process means that you assign them a risk factor. Are you a sex offender 1, 2, or 3? Well, as a result, as an unprocessed sex offender, this guy's post-prison supervision ended more than a decade ago. Last Tuesday night, the police found him with an 11-year-old girl who'd been reported missing from her home. Imagine the horror for those parents. This girl, 11 years old, is found with an unregistered sex offender who has not been processed by the government of Tina Kotek. He has now been charged with providing methamphetamine to a minor, 11 years old, with first-degree attempted rape and first-degree kidnapping. All of this is well within the control of the executive of the state of Oregon. It's Tina Kotek's job to tell the Department of Corrections to process about 12,000 unprocessed sex offenders. And when they don't, it is your daughters, it is your granddaughters who are at risk. Tell Tina Kotek to get busy actually doing her job instead of doing politics and dealing with her mentally ill and alcoholic wife. Back in a moment, it's the Northwest Nonsense up next. Hey there, it's Lo.
Exercising the right to free speech every day. This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
You know, it's hard enough to deal with the near 100-degree days like the heat that is hitting this week, and no, it's not climate change. But putting up with the ridiculous climate change nonsense and all the government blather that goes with it makes it even worse. Guaranteed that the news will be featuring lots of stories tonight on how people stayed cool, accompanied by propaganda lectures about how this is all the result of global warming, driven by, of course, the evil demon of fossil fuels. It's not. How do I know that? I know because more than a decade ago, various folks like Al Gore, who made hundreds of millions of dollars on the scam, projected that the Arctic would be ice-free in just 5 years. That was over a decade ago. It's still frosty there. If you need some entertainment while you swelter today, consider what the local government offers up. Advice from government agencies that can't run a popsicle stand on their own or a daycare center, staying out of the sun and drinking lots of fluids, as though we citizens are a bunch of idiot children who'd never get through the day without the assistance of our government betters. Advice from government agencies that inform you we are short of power, so only cool your home just so much, say to 80 degrees, while they use your taxpayer money to gift air conditioners to the less fortunate and even pay their electric bills. Multnomah County chose not to open its cooling centers, suggesting the overheated go to libraries instead. So, they want the frail elderly to head to places that are notoriously populated by drug-addicted homeless? I think I'd rather sweat it out. Our question of the day, and is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and you get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Jerry writes in, Lars, I was looking at the national debt clock yesterday, the one from Pete Peterson, and it was increasing slightly. Today, it appears to be going down by about $3 million a minute. Is this from Trump policy or something else? I just haven't seen it go in that direction, not that I watch it that close. Signed, Jerry. Well, I think the answer is Donald Trump is causing America to bring in more revenues, and he's causing the amount of spending to go down, not as much as I'd like to see it go down, but it's going down all the same. The fact is, we might be able to get that debt clock to run the other direction, and that would be good for all of us. My favorite post on X today, but you can always send me more suggestions. This one came from a young lady. Lars, my name is Farrah Leach, or Leach. I am currently with my husband in the cardiac ICU at the University of Washington. I typically listen to your show during my commute to my hair salon in Redmond, where my family and I reside. We were transferred here from OHSU due to my husband's condition. My husband is a hardworking roofing contractor of over 30 years. He's been diagnosed with a genetically inherited heart condition requiring a transplant. We've been informed he may not be eligible for one without a COVID vaccination. A friend, Scott Stewart from People's Rights, an organization we're part of, provided me with your contact information. I'd love to talk about the opportunity, the matter more. I'm glad for your time and consideration. Sincerely, warmest regards, Farrah Leach. Well, she sent a GoFundMe, and the GoFundMe is called Standing Strong for Brian Family in the Fight for His Life. I don't have any connection to the Leach family, but it sounds like a good cause. If you want to get that link, send me an email and I'll take care of that. That's talk@LarsLarson.com. And now our Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to Senator Ron Wyden. Senator Ron Wyden does not live in the Pacific Northwest. He certainly doesn't live in the state of Oregon. He lives in New York City with his wife and his grade school age kids. I think they're still grade school age kids. Now, I'm not doxing out Ron Wyden. Fact is, he doesn't have much connection to Oregon anymore. But more to the point, Ron Wyden is now in decade number 5. He's been in the Congress for 50 years. And in fact, I think it's fair to say that Ron Wyden has never drawn a private sector paycheck in his life. I mean, maybe a part-time job when he was a kid, but he's been in government his entire political career. He is 5 decades in the Congress, and guess what? Ron Wyden is going to run for senator again. And I think shame on him, and frankly, shame on folks like the Daily Dead Fish Rapper, Oregon Live. And why? Because back when Senator Bob Packwood was a member of the U.S. Senate, but a Republican, they made a big deal of the fact that Bob Packwood had a tenuous connection to the state of Oregon. He came back here a lot, and he had a place that was his official residence. I believe it was a mobile home on a friend's property, but at least he had some connection here, and he had no real connection other than to, in Washington, D.C., to a small apartment. Ron Wyden makes his home in New York City. And why is that? Because his wife owns a major business, a big bookstore that she got the old-fashioned way by inheriting it from her dad or her granddad. But she has a major business in New York City. They have kids in school in New York City. His wife is registered to vote in New York City. And yet Ron Wyden maintains the fiction that he is somehow connected to the state of Oregon. He has now announced that he plans to seek another term in 2028 when he will be 79 years of age. Another term will be 6 years, which means that when he takes office, he will finish out somewhere in his late 80s. And all of this, as we already have seen what happens when you put somebody like Joe Biden into a public office and he doesn't know. And all the Oregonian wants to say is Ron Wyden has traveled all 36 counties every year that he's been in the Senate. He intends to keep on doing so. He holds town hall meetings and all of that. He says questions about his age are fair game for debate, but he is up for the job. And apparently in 2028, 3 years from now, he will plan to do another 6 years beyond that in the U.S. Senate. And all of that allegedly representing the state of Oregon from his home in New York City. If you've got no problem with that, okay. But if you think that it's okay for somebody to represent a state as its member as one of the two members in the U.S. Senate, from 2,500 miles away, I'd love to hear that naysayer call. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. And send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, I'm glad to take your calls at 866-439-5277. Our email of the day so far, but you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. They did it for me. It is beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. Perry Allen writes in, Lars, I try to catch your show as frequently as possible, seem to share your opinions and outlook nearly all of the time. I'm certainly not informed or knowledgeable about the style of government as you are. I have a question you may be able to educate me about. It seems that Trump dictating what pharmaceutical companies can charge for their products in this country or calling for the owner of the company to step down seems just because it would compromise our security fits perfectly as a socialist attitude. Actually, Mr. Allen, I'll answer it this way. Trump has said to the pharmaceutical companies, if you're going to sell Americans pills for $10, you have to sell them for the same price to foreigners overseas. If you're going to sell pills to foreigners overseas for $2, then you have to sell them to Americans for $2. I don't think there's anything unfair about that. And as far as the chip company, the guy who's head of Intel has all those ties to the Chinese Communist Party. He should step down.
The Lars Larson Show. The sound of freedom. Here's Lars Larson.
We will be building a bridge.
Ah, ha, ha, ha. Yeah, that's Ann McInerney Ogle, the mayor of Vancouver. She has been on this program before. She has been invited since. She's never wanted to come back on. Apparently, she finds it laughable to talk about the bridge. The bridge that she was interviewed about, and I'll give full credit to K2 News, although they ought to send an adult along to do the interview next time. Because when K2 News sat down with the mayor of Vancouver, this young lady who did the interview did something I absolutely despise as a reporter. If you ask somebody a question and they don't answer it, then you politely ask it a second time, maybe with a little new sharpness to the edge of that question. And then if you have to ask it a third time to get the answer to the question, you ask it in a very blunt form that makes it clear. This is what I want to know. I've asked you a reasonable question. If you don't give me an answer, we're going to, you know, we're going to play word games for a while. But at least you make it clear. This young lady sat there and read questions off a piece of paper. So she's interviewing a major politician who has a central role in what may end up being a $9 billion bridge, a bridge that is so ridiculously expensive you can't believe it. And most of the reason for that bridge is, of course, light rail. And we'll get into that in just a moment. But here is Ann McInerney Ogle laughing about it when she's asked, do you have the money to build the bridge? And the honest answer to that is they don't have the money. They don't even have half of the money that it's going to take. And yet she effectively admits, although the young lady reporter who was talking to her didn't have the smarts to spot it. And I would say that to her face, believe me, Ann McInerney Ogle's face, to the reporter's face. I say, this politician is laughing at you. You've asked her a question. Do you have the money to build the bridge? She does not answer your question. And you move along as though, well, she just gave me an answer. She just said, we're going to be building a bridge. And then she goes on to admit, well, you know, we don't have the money. But you know what? Once the project is started, we understand that they're not going to have a choice but to go ahead and build the bridge. Let me get into the rest of what came out of that interview in just a moment. First, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. It serves Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And I'm glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you're a naysayer, I'm going to put you right to the head of the list. But on that subject, the light rail component of what now may be a $9 billion bridge, if we're lucky, it'll come in at only $7 billion, and they don't have the money, not even half of the money, that they need to build it, and yet they plan to start construction next year, and then it's going to take 5 to 7 to 10 years to get it done. And along the way, I know that what they're anticipating is we're going to run out of money. And then we're going to go to the taxpayers and say, well, we're halfway into this thing. You can't very well quit now. I mean, all of us have been, I think most of us have been, around projects where once you're halfway into it, you go to the boss and say, I need more money to finish that project. And when your boss says, well, you were given a budget and you spent the budget and now it's gone, you say, boss, that's fine. Do you want me to quit in the middle of this project? All of the money we've put in already will be wasted. Your project will not be finished, or you can give me more money. Playing chicken like that with the taxpayers, as far as I'm concerned, is absolutely evil. But let's start with the issue of light rail at $2 billion, or more than $1 billion a mile. And that light rail will go all of 0.9 miles, less than 5,000 feet into the state of Washington. And what does Ann McInerney Ogle say about it?
We would not have a bridge without Oregon and Portland saying, yes, let's build a bridge. That was one of their requirements, and the Vancouver City Council took that vote. And representing the council, the answer to your question is yes. We support bringing light rail over and dropping it in downtown Vancouver.
In downtown Vancouver, as long as you consider that less than 5,000 feet into the state of Washington over the Columbia River is going to be into downtown Vancouver. Look, I live in Vancouver. I know where downtown Vancouver is. Light rail isn't going to go anywhere near to downtown. It's going to stick about 4,000 and some odd feet into the state of Washington, 0.9 miles, and it's going to cost over $1 billion a mile to build it. And then TriMet, which is a transit agency that has been losing money left and right, has declining ridership, is going to turn to the people in Southwest Washington and say, nah, tag, you're it. Now that we've touched the state of Washington, you have to give us tens of millions of dollars to support a light rail line that does not serve your community. Now, if you like that idea, fine. And then she asked the question, and I thought it was a good question. The young lady should have just simply asked or demanded an answer to the question. Here's how the question went. Is there the money?
The two grants that have been approved already can get the project started and move the bridge project forward. I wouldn't be surprised in 6, 7, 8 years some of the other pieces of the project are not fulfilled. They may have to be picked up by the states, those on and off ramps and those types of pieces. But right now we can build the bridge if we don't continue to delay the process.
Yeah, so you can build the bridge but not the on or off ramps. So in other words, You're going to get the bridge project that far done and then turn to the states and say, I'm sorry, we ran short. We underestimated. Now, do you notice the other thing she did? She had told this young lady that bridge project will take 5 to 7 years. And then she says, I wouldn't be surprised if 6 or 7 or 8 years into the project. Hold on. You just told me it was going to take 5 to 7 years. And now you're saying 6 or 7 or 8 years into the project. By then, the project's supposed to be done. Yeah, but a whole bunch of pieces won't be done. And of course, there isn't the money to do them. And you guys are going to have to spend the money. And then comes this critical issue, the issue of tolling, which is opposed on both sides of the river.
Tolling has always been a part of the funding package. The two states, the federal government, and a user fee, sometimes called the toll. So there isn't a major project of this magnitude in the entire United States that doesn't have tolling as part of the funding package. We knew that that would be a possibility going into it way back in the 90s, in the early 2000s, and into this project.
Now, hold on a second. Do you hear the kind of doublespeak coming out of Ann McInerney Ogle? She says it's always been part of the project, and then she says it was always a possibility. Well, which one was it? And the fact is, tolling is opposed in Southwest Washington. Tolling is opposed in Portland. It is opposed in other parts of Oregon because ODOT wants tolling, and they're hiring people to start the project, the process of creating the tolls and the way to collect the tolls. And I don't mean a toll plaza, but just like in Seattle, you're being told, yes, you oppose it, and yes, we're going to do it anyway. But when she says tolling, oh, it's always been part of the project. There is no other federal highway project in America without tolling. That is pure hogwash. Federal law says that federal freeways are to remain tolling free unless they are granted an exemption. And the exemption is only granted if you show that you will increase capacity. Well, that's the best part of all this. A $5 to $7 to $9 billion bridge that is smaller than the current bridge. The current bridge has 3 lanes each way. The new bridge will have 3 lanes each way, except on the new bridge, the way they've laid it out, 54% of the bridge surface will be allocated for bicycles and pedestrians and light rail trains. 54%. That means 46%, less than half of a multi-billion dollar bridge will be for the trucks and the cars that carry almost all the cargo and 95% of commuters. So, and McInerney Ogle says, well, you know what? We're going to do it. We're going to be building a bridge come hell or high water. They do not have Coast Guard approval. They do not have the money. They certainly don't have support for, and they do have public opposition to tolling, and they're going to do it anyway, and they're going to shove it down your throats. Back in a moment. It's Monday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
We're with Dr.
Your courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
Be honest. You're listening because you like what you hear. Right? Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. I love starting an hour of the first day of the week with a naysayer, and I want to do that. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Let me go to Brett, who's a naysayer. Brett, welcome to the program. We love naysayers. What do we disagree about today that makes you one?
Well, less of a disagreement and more of, I agree with you that government basically ruins everything it touches, and I don't think this bridge will be any different.
Agreed.
But when we're talking about tolls, you always say that, like with Amtrak and Max and all those, let the people who ride the train pay the bill.
Agreed.
How is it any different with tolling? I live down on the south coast. I don't use that bridge. So why don't you guys pay for the bridge?
Well, you may not be aware, Brett, you will be paying for the bridge. Would you like to know how? Well,
obviously.
No, you'll be paying for it with tolls.
How am I paying for it? Well, cost of goods.
Every single thing. I would guess that most of the consumer goods that you consume come on a truck to Seattle or Portland or, you know, Port of Tacoma or
well,
Port
sure,
of,
but that would make me a user of those goods. So that would be, you know, I would make
that's right.
pay my portion.
Yeah. So you
but
know,
when you're
you
traveling on that, how is it different? That's what I'm wanting
well,
to know.
See, and the
how
thing
is your
is,
point of view different?
Don't get me wrong.
Him.
It's not any different. It's just that I oppose tolling. The majority of people in Oregon oppose tolling. The majority of people
and
in
I would
Washington.
Say I do too, obviously.
And,
but
and
I just
so,
don't know why the opinion's different.
Well, I'm not saying it's different. I didn't. You're the one who said you were a naysayer. All I'm saying is that when you've got people like Ann McInerney Ogle, the mayor of Vancouver, who is invited to come on this program, and while she got softballs thrown at her by K2 in that interview, if you can call it an interview, a young girl reading questions off a piece of paper, and when she asked, do you have the money to build the project? The honest answer was no. And if you listen, so if you...
Yeah, but my naysayer point is strictly on how you feel about Amtrak and MAX versus tolls. That's all.
I'm not saying it's the same.
With you on all the other things.
And by the way, so, can I point something out about the tolls? If you think it's just me saying I don't want to pay the tolls, I find the tolls anti-democratic. And let me tell you why. Because, you know, we live in a region that is full to the brim and overflowing with liberal progressives who always tell you, well, we got to help out the least among us. Brett, do you think I have any problem paying the toll if I cross the bridge, even though the tolls may be as high as $20 a day to be able to come and go? Well, I can pay that toll, but you know what they're aiming it at? They're going to call it congestion pricing. And what that means is, price the poor people off the roads. Now, does that sound like the kind of policy that most liberal progressives would pursue, saying, let's just charge enough that all the poor people can't do it?
I mean, yeah, they've drove the cost of living in Portland up to where, I mean, I think that place is a disaster. Avoid it at all costs. But I'm sure that's what they want to do. But if those are the people that are using the bridge, then those are the ones that pay the bill, you know?
And yet they always talk about progressivity. So if they say, well, should we have a progressive tax system where somebody who makes a lot of money pays 40%, 39% to the IRS, and somebody who doesn't make much money at all, a couple that makes less than $25,000 a year, pays zero federal income tax. They're always all about progressivity. And then when it comes to tolling, the young lady or the young man who has to get to work and has to drive across that bridge and then has to pay a toll of up to $20 a day is going to be told, I'm sorry, we're going to suck $400 a month out of your pocket in post-tax income, and too bad. And they're going to make
right.
it very
like
difficult.
Like I said, I'm not a naysayer on the tolls. I told you in the beginning, I 100% agree. I think tolls are bad. I'm just wondering how you think that the riders should pay their own way, but tolls are any different.
And that's the answer why, Brett, because while you would pay a little bit because the truck carrying your consumer goods to you from one of the ports in the Northwest, either up or down the freeway, you end up having to pay some of that cost. But paying for bridges ought to be to benefit anybody and everybody who benefits from those bridges. Well, as I just told you, I think everybody in the region benefits from being able to get across the river. Would you agree?
In the region, yeah, that's why you guys pay for it. No,
but you're thinking of yourself as not being in the region, and yet if you have consumer goods that are coming to you because they came into the Port of Tacoma, got loaded on a truck, and the truck went across that bridge and ended up in Myrtle Point, you are getting some of the benefit of that bridge. You need to pay for some of the bridge is my point of view. Let me go to BT. Hey, BT, what's on your mind?
Yeah, Lars, you know, that's a good point always about how they, you know, people like these light rail people want to get light rail just a little foothold into Vancouver, because then they'll be able to say, as you've explained, says, well, now that we have it there, you know, we need to add more. Otherwise, it's, you know, the investment isn't really worth it. We need to
yep.
have more. That reminds me of that old story about the hobo in the 30s making rock soup, and he gets people to give him like a carrot here and a potato there. Next thing you know, he's got this vegetable soup because he just had this little starter kit. So the California high-speed rail is a rare example of where people just said, no, sorry, you've had enough. And that's really
no, the California that's got killed by Donald Trump.
It yeah, that's not, what I mean. I mean, they thought that once they started it, they'd be able to get money, to keep continuing it. And they may get it if we get another Democrat president. It's probably going to give it to them. But at least it's rare to actually see it stop saying, sorry, you wasted enough money. Forget it.
And they should have done it a long time ago. BT, thanks for the call, and I appreciate it. It's Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson
Show. Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Soda pop and SNAP benefits. I want to talk about that. And there's something kind of amazing going on in American politics. But then again, it's the Trump administration. So wouldn't you expect amazing out of that? But now they want to ban soda from being purchased with SNAP or EBT benefits. It is literally something that both parties have talked about doing. Both Democrats and Republicans have said maybe we shouldn't let people buy soda pop, which is basically sugar water carbonated in a can. Maybe we shouldn't let them spend their SNAP benefits on that. Now, I know it's being portrayed as a health issue when it comes from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Frankly, I don't agree with RFK, and I don't want the government telling me what I should eat and what I shouldn't eat. That is your business to decide. It is not the government's place to tell you what to eat. However, when it comes to SNAP benefits, I think it is my business what you decide to spend your money on. And I know I'm going to get arguments from people who say, well, how come the government can tell me what to do with SNAP benefits? Because the government allocates those benefits. They take money from law-abiding tax-paying citizens and they give it to other people who say, I'm short of the resources I need to be able to feed my family. Okay, we'll give you some supplemental nutritional assistance. That's where they get the name SNAP. Well, if they're giving you supplemental assistance, do the people giving the money have something to say about how you spend that money? Let me get to that in just a moment. First, welcome to a Monday on the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, I'm going to put you right to the head of the list. Actually, my producers put you right to the head of the list. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, you know I like metaphors and you know I like food. Listen, we have had over the years at various times, Tina and I have had extended family members who said, hey, we're a little short this month. And we say, that's all right. We'll be glad to help you out. Sometimes we take them down to the, you know, to the store and buy groceries. Sometimes we've offered some money to help people out. But if somebody came to me from the family and said, Lars, I'm short of cash. I mean, I'm really up against it. And I gave them some money to be able to tide them through. And then I ran into them at, say, the grocery store or the gas station buying $100 worth of lottery tickets. I would say, you know, if you've got money to spend on lottery tickets, then you're really not short. I'm not giving you any more assistance. Now, this is nothing more than that. But there are now one dozen states, one quarter of America's 50 states, have now decided to limit the amount of soft drinks, sugary beverages, energy drinks, and candy that you can buy with EBT. I think that is endlessly sensible. To simply say, if you're short of money to buy food, we will give you EBT to buy food. But if you've got the money to go out and waste it on things like soda pop and candy and things like that. Now, I know there are going to be people who say, well, but Lars, are you saying that a mom on welfare who's getting EBT or SNAP benefits is not able to buy her kids some candy? No, she can buy her kids some candy. But if you start treating SNAP like it is every bit of your food budget, and sadly, I think there are people who do that. They say, why, my whole food budget is SNAP. That's not what supplemental means. What supplemental means is that if you're short of money, we're going to give you some additional help to buy groceries, not to buy sugar water in a can, not to buy candy and things like that. And I know we're going to get people who object to this, but the extraordinary thing I mentioned to you is this, that people from both political parties, both Republicans and Democrats, have said, yeah, we probably ought to at least eliminate soda pop from SNAP. But nobody's been willing to do it until the Trump administration came along. And now, even though I disagree with RFK Jr. on a whole bunch of things, and even though I think he's portraying this as a health-oriented move, as though he's going to use EBT to force people to eat or drink in a more healthy way, I still think it's right. I think that if you want to buy a whole bunch of soda pop, buy it with your own money. If you want to buy it with SNAP or EBT, you ain't going to do it. Let me go first to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lush, when my mom and dad separated 2 years ago, and, you know, the LBJ plan, she got an apartment and everything else. With the four basic food groups, the meats and everything else, you had to buy your own flour, your own cornmeal, your own lard, whatever the heck else. We should not be enabling. And to back up what I said, Lush, when since 1979 on the Carter bill, they opened that program even wider. That's when the first widening to buy sodas, because you couldn't buy sodas. You could buy juices. You can buy fruits and vegetables and stuff. And then as a kid who lived through it, you can see the obesity from that time point, plus adding to not letting the kids work during the summer or part-time, 10, 12 hours a week from 11 years old on up. If I didn't have that chance, Lars, I would not become the man that I had. Being in a foster home, by working, by earning everything that you need, and it wasn't given, and it's not entitled. You got the main stuff first. If you want everything else, it was treated as a treat, not government should be paying for it.
By the way, Ron, I know there are people out there saying, are you expecting the grocer to try to sort out what's allowed and what's not? The grocery store doesn't do it anymore. It's done in a computer. When you walk up to the and I've seen people walk up to the checkout line with EBT cards, and most of their groceries go through, and then the clerk says, okay, your EBT covers this much of your groceries, but you bought some things that are not on the list. You bought some beer. You bought some wine. You literally, and I was kind of surprised when I first heard this years ago, if you want to buy laundry soap, that is not covered by EBT. If you want to carry bath soap, that is not covered by EBT. If you want to buy a multivitamin, that is a supplemental nutritional supplement, that's not covered by EBT, nor should it be. But all of that is done by a computer. You just simply scan the article, and it's either EBT qualified or it's not. We could very easily say, these things are covered, these things are not. That's the way it is. That's the benefit you're going to get, and you ought to say thank you to the taxpayers around you. Let me go to let's go to Jerry. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to talk about this EBT up in Hood River here just the other day. I don't think these people should be able to buy expensive steaks. This guy, I'm walking through the parking lot, and he's trying to get my attention. He wanted to sell this big steak, and I'm thinking he stole it, but he didn't steal it. He showed me the receipt. He bought it with the EBT card. It was a $90 steak. He's trying to sell it for $25.
He's committing fraud, and you know that, right? And you know that he's doing is already illegal because EBT says you are not allowed to sell your benefits. Now, I think he thought, well, if I turn it into a steak and then I sell the steak, that somehow I'm not committing food stamp fraud. But frankly, he is. And I hope people start turning folks in for that. I hope they say, hey, if you've got the money to go buy an expensive steak, but you want to buy something you can't buy with your EBT card, like beer or heroin or fentanyl or weed or lottery tickets or whatever it is you're buying with it, then you're committing food stamp fraud. I think citizens ought to snap a picture of that person and then call up the food stamp folks and say, look, there's somebody out there committing food stamp fraud, and here is the visual proof. Jerry, thanks for the call. Back in a moment. It's Monday. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
Simply by listening, you're proving how smart you really are. Lars thanks you.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's my pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I got to tell you something. I know we've got a special session of the Oregon legislature coming up in about 17 or 18 days, and I swear the Democrats have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. And one of them, Lou Frederick, is a member of the Oregon Senate. We've asked him on the show. It used to be that Lou came on often enough that he actually got a nickname on the show because we called him Angry Lou Frederick, because every time he came on to talk about the subjects and we'd ask him reasonable questions, he would start to blow a gasket. I mean, he just couldn't handle tough questions. So I watched an interview with him this weekend. It was actually done by Ken Boddy over at the CBS affiliate, KOIN. And he was asking, well, you know, what are you going to do about these transportation problems? And he started to run that old line that says, oh, we've got so many electric cars and the revenue we're getting from gas taxes is going down. And then Lou actually said something. Joel, do we have that soundbite from Angry Lou? I want to play this because this guy is a state lawmaker. Not just that, but he's what's known as the Democrat Party whip, which the whip's job is to whip up enthusiasm or support for a particular piece of legislation. So if they've got a piece of legislation and they want to get all the Democrats going about it, I mean, the Democrats have a supermajority, so they don't have any problem passing bills. But he's the guy who goes around to all the different members of the Democrat Party in the legislature, the one with the supermajority, and says, I really need to get your vote on this bill. You want to see how clueless the Democrats are about ODOT? Listen to this from Angry Lou Frederick, member of the state Senate.
If you want to get to a hospital or a medical issue, and you live in LeGrand and you need to get to Portland for that medical issues, there is not a public transportation aspect to that. You cannot get here easily.
Now, hold on a second. This is Angry Lou Frederick saying, why, if you live in LeGrand or Pendleton, that sort of area, you can't get to Portland on transit. Well, as a matter of fact, you can. There is the Flixbus, bus. It runs once a day. There is the Trailways bus. It runs once a day. But what I found kind of bizarre about what Angry Lou had to say, let's say you need to get to a hospital and you're in LeGrand, which, by the way, is a four-hour drive at about 70 miles an hour to Portland. Now, I don't know what would cause you to say, I got to get to a hospital in a city 4 hours away when I've got perfectly good hospitals here, but maybe you need to go see a specialist or something like that. You don't have a way to get there easily on public transit. Well, an awful lot of people who live in rural areas of the state, they don't plan on public transit. They plan on, and my wife's going to drive me, or my buddy's going to drive me to the hospital or whatever. But there are, in fact, bus services, commercial bus services. But apparently Angry Lou thinks there ought to be a public bus that runs from Pendleton or LeGrand all the way to Portland, or maybe a light rail line. I mean, at $1 billion a mile, it only costs about $200 billion to build it all the way out to LeGrand. I don't know that Lou is proposing that, but this is the kind of guy who's actually in the leadership of the Democrat Party saying, yeah, the problem with ODOT, it's not that we're not building highways, we're not building bridges, we can't build a bridge without light rail. No, his concern is there isn't enough public transit that runs from LeGrand, Oregon, all the way to Portland. That's the big issue for Angry Lou Frederick. Again, Senator Frederick is welcome to come on the program. He used to work in TV news, and then he worked for a school district, and now for the last, I don't know, couple of decades, he's served in the Oregon legislature. And if you want to see why things are screwed up that badly, it's because people like Angry Lou Frederick are in that kind of position. A guy who seems to think the biggest issue in the Northwest is that there's no public bus that runs from LeGrand all the way to Portland, but there are commercial alternatives that run much better, and they actually run and make a profit. Let's go to Mike in Snoqualmie. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. What's on your mind? No, it sounds like Mike's phone gave up. Sorry about that. Let's go to Mike. Hey, another Mike. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I've served as a senior pastor in the church and pastor in various functions for over 28 years now. And I've just noticed that there's been a shift, I guess, in my lifetime around this EBT program. I guess I'm showing my age a little bit here, but I can remember when things used to be called by different names. It started off, as you recall, they originally called it the food stamp program because you actually receive stamps.
Yep.
And they're placed on cards, and then it changed to EBT, and I think sometimes it's called the SNAP program. What I've noticed with a lot of this, you know, back in the past, when people had to reach out for assistance, whether it be from a church, which back in the day, you know, quite a bit of the assistance that people did get came from nonprofit organizations, either food banks or churches.
And usually faith-based.
Like right, faith-based. And here's the thing, when you're overseeing a nonprofit organization, funds are kind of hard to come by, and you never really have enough to do everything that you'd like to do, and you really can't help everyone, and that forces you to be very responsible with your money. You've got to pick and choose, you know, who you can help and under what circumstances.
Yep.
And the federal government, you know, it's not their money, and I guess I sort of have a problem. I don't want to see anybody go hungry on the one hand. On the other hand, I guess I have a little bit of a problem when it's a little bit like our taxes, you know, that they kind of take at the threat of a gun that you're going to pay your taxes, and then they're not very discriminatory about how they're going to use those funds.
And they should be. Mike, I've often used churches as an example. I mean, if I came to a church and said, hey, I lost my job a couple of weeks ago. I've been looking hard for another job. Can't find one yet, but I'm going to get there. But my family's hungry, and I don't have any money for groceries. The church hands you a box of food. You know, many churches run a program like that. When you're 3 months into coming and getting a box of food once a week from the church, you think the church, long before you hit the three-month mark, is going to say, are you really looking for a job? Because we know of some people who could put you to work right now. And when the guy says, no, I really don't feel like getting a job. I get food from you guys once a week. Why would I need to go get a job? Then at that point, you cut him off. Do you not?
Yeah, that's precisely what we do. We decided that early on that so that we could have enough money to help the people who truly needed it, we started asking some serious questions like that. Because the Bible, you know, and I'm not trying to, you know, preach at other people here, but
feel free to.
The Bible also says, well, the Bible says that if a man won't work, neither should he eat.
Exactly.
And so I believe that if you're not willing to make a diligent effort to try to go out and get a job, when I give you that box of food, as you say, month after month, and you just keep taking from the funds, that prevents us from being able to help people who truly need it, people that are desperately in need. And I've had some people in the past, you know, they kind of criticize me for that, and they just wanted me to just give it, you know, regardless. And I'd say, well, you know, our church doesn't believe in stealing. And they looked at me. I kind of developed this, right? And they always looked at you like you're one. They wondered what you meant. What do you mean stealing? And I said, well, I don't want to steal from you. I don't want to deprive you of your self-esteem. I don't want to steal your pride. I don't want to steal from your ability to have some personal achievement. And so,
that's right. And Mike, the fact is, if somebody is coming to you saying, I need help, and they genuinely need it, you give to them. If they say, I need help, but I choose not to help myself, then as far as I'm concerned, they're stealing as well. Mike,
the
thanks
Lars
for the call.
Larson Show. Just think of him as your concealed carry. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And the talk of the United States today is Donald Trump's plan to make D.C. great again. I don't think it translates to an easy kind of acronym that you can put on a hat. But Donald Trump actually came out today and he said, look, I'm going to go after crime in Washington, D.C. It's a national embarrassment that the seat of our federal government is actually a place that is hugely violent. Take a listen to how he announced that today.
I'm announcing a historic action to rescue our nation's capital from crime, bloodshed, bedlam, and squalor, and worse. This is Liberation Day in D.C., and we're going to take our capital back. We're taking it back.
Yeah, we're taking it back. Now, you know what the response from liberals is? I mean, even Muriel Bowser, the mayor of Washington, D.C., has acknowledged they have a crime problem. And over the last several years, I've told you over and over again, when D.C. makes moves, they usually make moves to change the law so that if you commit violent crime, that there is a lesser punishment attached to that. It's some kind of weird, progressive, backwards logic that says if you actually punish people for committing violent crime, why, that doesn't work as well as not punishing them. No, not punishing them tells them to go ahead and do it again. They want to flood the streets of D.C. with more than 100 FBI agents. The president has always already federalized and activated the National Guard. And he says they're going to go after the National Guard is going to go after making the streets of D.C. safe again. Listen to that.
In addition, I'm deploying the National Guard to help reestablish law, order, and public safety in Washington, D.C., and they're going to be allowed to do their job properly.
Yeah. Now, here's one of the first things you're going to hear. Just let me warn you that this is coming at you. You've already got major publications that are telling you, don't believe your lying eyes. Crime is actually way down in Washington, D.C. It's hitting new lows. And, oh, the problem isn't as bad as Trump says it is. The only problem with that is an awful lot of Washington, D.C. correspondents, even the ones who work for the cartel media, like ABC News, had an anchor who came on today and said, look, we've had two shootings in the last 2 months within two blocks of the ABC News Bureau in Washington, D.C. And this young lady said that her colleague's car was stolen just that morning and that she was actually jumped and mugged just a couple of blocks away from where ABC News has its D.C. headquarters. The problem is, if you go out and you try to tell people who are covering the news, even the ones who are part of the liberal media, even the ones who hate Donald Trump with a passion, and they love Joe Biden back when he was in office because he was easy to cover, he didn't move very fast, they're going to know that it isn't true. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, although I haven't been back to D.C. in a few years, when you go to Washington, D.C., people who live there warn you to stay away from certain neighborhoods at any time of the day or night, and especially after dark, certain neighborhoods are just dangerous. Now, should that be the case? Well, the thing that I'm seeing from a lot of mainstream media, and especially the left-wing media, folks like Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, New York Times, and all that is, well, no, the numbers say that crime is down. I've told you why the numbers say that. If 5 years ago, major cities decided we're going to defund the police. Why? Because the mob in the streets is demanding that we defund the police. Isn't that the way that representative government works in America? That if a mob of a few hundred or a couple of thousand people forms in the streets of your city and they make a demand, and even though they're a tiny fraction of the hundreds of thousands or millions of people who live in your city, the politicians listen to the mob. Well, they defunded the cops. What do you think you get when you have fewer cops? You have fewer reports of crime. And there's another phenomenon that's harder to track, but let me describe it to you this way. When you as a citizen find out that if you call the police and say, hey, my business just got robbed, and the police say, well, we don't have a lot of officers right now, so we'll try to get around to you as soon as we can, but go online and file a report. And when people realize that the police aren't going to do much about it when your business is robbed, when your house gets burgled, when there's a minor mishap of some kind or a minor criminal assault of some kind. And so at some point, citizens sensibly say, well, if the police aren't going to do much about it, what is the point of calling the police and reporting that a crime has happened? Consider this, that just a couple of months ago, mid-May of this year, a gentleman who works for the D.C. police, Michael Pulliam, and he was working as one of the former commanders of the 3rd District that patrols Adams Morgan, that's one of their neighborhoods, and Columbia Heights. Adams Morgan is a place, when I went to D.C., my friends who live there said, don't go anywhere near that neighborhood, it's dangerous. He was placed on paid leave back in May of this year and told that he was under investigation for questionable changes that had been made to crime data. Law enforcement sources had said this guy got sidelined because he was changing the numbers, paid on placed on paid leave because he'd been manipulating them. That happened after he filed an equal opportunity complaint against an assistant chief and the police union, accused the department of deliberately falsifying crime data, according to three law enforcement sources. So you've got people within the police agency who say, we're going to put out fake numbers out there. And why? Because they're politically advantageous to people like Muriel Bowser. They can say, well, you may think there's more crime here, but the actual numbers say otherwise. And that is what you're going to see reported on major news sites, on newspapers, if you've still got a newspaper, on the network news. Second issue, just a few hours after President Trump had announced that he was putting federal law enforcement, including FBI and federalized National Guard, on the streets of Washington, D.C. Here's this report from just a few hours ago. Authorities in Washington seized two stolen firearms and illegal drugs just hours after the president told those federal law enforcement officials to go out and start patrolling the streets of the nation's capital. And here was the report. U.S. Park Police said our officers and federal partners collaborated to enforce Executive Order 14252, making the District of Columbia safe and beautiful. Our teams made arrests for the possession of two stolen firearms and illegal drugs, removing these dangerous items from the community. So the question is, are you going to believe your lying eyes, or are you going to believe your government masters who say, don't worry about crime, our official numbers show that it's not a problem at all? And I'd remind you that just last week we were talking about the fact that the jobs report came out, and gee, Donald Trump didn't look so good in the jobs report. And then people said, but he's firing the person, a woman, who is in charge of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Well, what was that woman's department doing all of last year? They were artificially boosting the number of jobs during the Biden administration and later during the candidacy of Kamala Harris. They boosted the number of jobs artificially by about 1.5 million. Now, how do you do that accidentally? It's one thing to make a minor error in an estimate up or down. But when you make consistently up errors that always show the current sitting power, you know, the folks in power, as doing a great job bringing lots and lots of jobs, then, and then at the end of the year say, oh, I'm sorry, we're going to have to adjust those numbers by more than 1 million jobs because the numbers we've been telling you all year long turn out to be wrong. If they monkey with the jobs numbers, does it surprise you one little bit when they start messing around with the numbers that describe crime? Instead, Trump's putting more federal officials out there. The mayor of D.C. has said, okay, fine, we'll accept their help. When they start making lots and lots of arrests, what are the liberals going to say about it at that point? Glad to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up on the Radio Northwest Network, when will Northwest residents finally push back against governments that want to tax them out of camping or even paddling on the river? That's next. I can
saying the things you wish you could say. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. This segment of the program is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Now, our X poll question today: should all members of Congress be forced to take and then publicly disclose an IQ test? The idea, which is not a brand new idea, I've certainly heard it any number of times on this program over the last decades. President Trump today called firebrand left-winger Representative Jasmine Crockett. She's a member of the Democrat Party. She represents, if you can call it that, a congressional district in Texas, that she is dumber than the country-destroying morons in the House of Representatives squad. You know, the so-called squad mates like Rashida Tlaib and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Trump has already said, He wants to see all of them take cognitive tests so that you know whether or not, number one, they're sane and whether or not they've got an IQ that beats room temperature. Now, Trump had issued a similar intelligence test challenge last month to Jasmine Crockett and AOC, who is part of the squad. Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett is a very low IQ individual, much in the mold of AOC, plus the three gang of country-destroying morons, only slightly dumber. So, to the idea that we've talked about so many times on this program, should every member of Congress be forced to take and then publicly disclose their IQ test? I would answer that one yes. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and on my website at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, on Friday, I ask you this, because I saw over the weekend there were a bunch of people talking about it, but on Friday, we made this our question, should the public forests ever be closed to the general public because of wildfire danger? Not because of a fire that's burning right now, but because the authorities have decided the public may not visit the public's forest because they might set it on fire. I said no. They do not justify closing the public forest. 79% of you agreed with me, but 21% of you were naysayers. And then over the weekend, I saw the premier of Nova Scotia, who's the one who came out with the warning. And boy, were they blunt. They said you are not allowed to go into the public forest. You may not go on a hike. You may not go fishing. You may not go hunting. You may not drive a vehicle of any kind there. And if we catch you doing it, the fine is going to be about $25,000 if you walk into the public forest as a member of the general public. Now, I thought that was absolutely crazy. And I had a few people say, well, you know, smokers. And I say, yes, I do. There are people who smoke cigarettes. About 15% of the population, the other 85%, does not smoke cigarettes. And of the cigarette smokers, I would venture to guess that the vast majority of them handle their butts just fine. They don't go out and toss a burning butt. Now, are there people who do that? Yes. Should you write the rules for the public forest based on the tiny, tiny number of people who don't follow the rules and may start a fire? I would answer no to that. I'm going to tell you, these are the public's forests. You should keep them safe. And then after I made mention of the fact that oftentimes forest fires are first spotted by people who are out hiking or fishing or hunting or otherwise recreating in the woods, I got a number of people, including some forest rangers, who wrote to me and said that's exactly how we spot a lot of the fires. Somebody happens to be out hiking. They get to a viewpoint. They see a fire. They call it in before anybody else would have spotted it, and they help us get on top of those things right away. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And by the way, on that note, as I said, that's Nova Scotia, that's Canada. But in the United States, the government has the same kind of attitude. The public may own these forests, but we don't just necessarily let the public into the public's forests. I think that's an absolutely un-American idea. And here's another un-American idea. The Taxpayer Association of Oregon, they point out the brand new $20 annual paddleboard or canoe fee or kayak permit fee. It is one of the only places in America, Oregon, where they actually make you buy a permit for an under 10-foot long floating vessel that has no motor, no engine on it. As a result, there was a protest stage this past weekend called Let Us Paddle. Paddleboarders will be charged another brand new $10 parking fee to use their $20 parking paddleboard permit. So in other words, it goes from where if a young man or woman or a kid owns a paddleboard or a kayak, you could probably go and have fun almost cost-free other than driving to the park. Now it's going to be $20 to put your boat in the water, $10 to park your car, and good luck. There goes recreation, except for the elite, of course, like Tina Kotek. Let's go to Tom in Tumwater. Hey, Tom, we're close to the break. What's on your mind?
Just real quick, I'm a longtime listener. I agree with you all the time. But where do you draw the line? If you're going to give a test to all the congressional people, do you give a test to all government people that get a government paycheck?
I wouldn't have a problem with that. Would you?
I'm not educated enough to give you an educated answer to that, but the thought crossed my mind when I was...
Well, here's the difference. If you work for the government, presumably they hire you based on your skills and abilities, now that we've gotten rid of DEI. If you run for public office, you are asking the voters to cast a vote and put you in that office. If you want to be in that office, I think the voters have a right to know whether or not you have a room temperature IQ or not. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And in some ways, the Democrats kind of make me chuckle because they're always talking about how much they hate gerrymandering anytime the gerrymandering does not work to their advantage. On the other hand, when they gerrymander the daylights out of congressional districts in big blue states, they seem to have no problem with gerrymandering at all, which is why it's so ironic that a bunch of Texas Democrats who are very much in the minority in Texas decided to flee the state of Texas because being in the legislature actually meant they would have to create a quorum that would allow the Republicans to vote through the kind of changes that were being made as a result of the last census. So where did they fly off to? Illinois. Well, that drew the attention also of Colin Anderson, who joins me now, executive editor at the Washington Free Beacon. Colin, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you? Thank you for having me.
I'm doing very well, although the Democrats keep proving what I've said for a long time, and that is if they didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards at all. But something you wrote at the Free Beacon I thought was hilarious. So when they jetted from Texas into Chicago and private planes took these Democrats away from the Lone Star State, when they landed, were their jets parked in the same congressional district?
Yeah, so this is a great question. A lot of people don't know this, but O'Hare International, Chicago's main airport, is actually not represented by one congressional district. It's represented by two. What you see from the congressional district coming out of Chicago is that they're basically these very long kind of skeleton-like tentacles that stretch from portions of Chicago out into the suburbs because you need to fit as many congressional districts as possible in these areas where you have lots of voters if you're the Democrats, and that's exactly what they've done under Governor J.B. Pritzker. And so most of these runways are located within the 5th congressional district, as is sort of the main terminals that you would walk around if you were flying in or out of O'Hare. But that's not the entirety of the airport. There are areas to the north and also to the west end of the airport that are represented by the 3rd congressional district. And so depending on where you land at O'Hare, depending on the runway that your flight takes, you may actually be landing in one congressional district and then taxiing to another, okay? And as I mentioned just now, this is not by accident. This is very much a design to say, how many of our districts can we cram into the Chicago area that we know we're going to do well in, and as a result minimizes many of the sort of more rural areas that Democrats struggle in Illinois as humanly possible.
I mean, Colin, I mean, for all the decades that I've talked about gerrymandering and redistricting on this show, it's a necessity. You need to stress that to people that when you recount the country in the census every 10 years, you've got to rewrite all the congressional districts. So every member of Congress represents, I think the number is right around 800,000 people. It's basically 330 or 340 million of us divided by 435 members of Congress. So it makes sense you'd redraw the districts. But then both political parties play games of that. But I think the Democrats to a much greater extent. Is there any way to solve this problem, to actually work out a system which is inherently political to begin with and depends on who's in the majority in the various states and in the Congress? Is there any way to fix this so that we could just have a sensible redistricting of America and leave the fun and games alone?
Yeah, well, look, there have been some proposals on the Democratic side that have attempted to sort of put the hands of redrawing these districts into quote-unquote independent commissions. The reason that I put that term in quotes is because, you know, this is sort of the idea and theory of these commissions that are redrawing these boundaries. It doesn't always work out that way in reality, and New York is a great example of this. Of course, New York being a place the Democrats are now talking about gerrymandering themselves in response to Texas Republicans. And in New York, you have a ballot measure that passed that puts the redistricting process in the hand of this commission. It is made up of Republicans, of Democrats, and of independents. The problem with this is that it is also part of this redistricting process, but the commission did not agree on maps that it can sort of all stand behind. The process actually goes back to the legislature, and the legislature is supposed to draw the boundaries in a way that do not benefit one political party over another. But the legislature in New York was recently tasked with doing this in the wake of the 2020 census because the state commission could not agree on a new map. And instead of drawing a map that sort of favored all parties in a way that reflects voters in New York, the legislature actually tried to produce a very egregious gerrymander that was then subject to all sorts of court challenges and whatnot. And so there have been attempts at this in theory. I'm not sure how well they have worked in reality.
Well, and in fact, it ends up being that they never complain about, at least I'm not aware, of the Democrats ever complaining about gerrymandering, which is done in all these blue states, but they only complain about it when it's used against them in the red states. So apparently they figure, you know, we can have the rules that benefit us, but the rules should not benefit you. And that's what they are, with a serious face, asking Americans to accept. Let it benefit the Democrats in the blue states, and then in the red states, just the whole nation stand up and shame Texas for having done the same thing in reverse in a red state.
Sure, and it's been interesting seeing J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, talk about these things because, you know, I think the idea behind the Texas Democrats going to Illinois was, hey, we know that Governor Greg Abbott is going to be trying to locate us and bring us back to Texas. We need to go to a state that is a blue state, that has a blue governor and legislature where we can be protected from such attempts. I'm not sure that they exactly thought through Illinois. I think that there are a number of blue states they could have gone to that maybe wouldn't have provided the example of hypocrisy that you outlined just now. And in fairness, J.B. Pritzker has been pressed on this during press conferences, during TV appearances, including, of all people, from Stephen Colbert, who held up the images of Illinois' congressional maps. And if you're wondering of what this looked like as an example, I would encourage you to Google these districts because they're very interesting looking. And you know, Stephen Colbert describes them and asked J.B. Pritzker, like, what do you have to say about these things? And it seems that the governor's argument has essentially been that, no, we don't benefit from gerrymandering. It just so happens that voters in Illinois really like the Democrats, and that's why they keep sending us back to Congress, and there's nothing to see here. And by the way, Texas Republicans are cheating. That argument obviously doesn't hold up to any scrutiny. And in fairness, J.B. has been pressed on it a little bit.
No, he has, and I'm glad to see him pressed on it, because if you can't point out that hypocrisy, I don't know how you get this problem fixed. That is Colin Anderson. Colin, thanks very much. Executive editor at the Washington Free Beacon. Glad to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up in a moment, are you ready for laboratory-grown butter that actually eliminates the cows? And the guy behind it is a familiar name. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Happy in informed and always guessing what he'll say next. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. There is an amazing number of crazy people on the left, including some fairly familiar names like the billionaire, multi-billionaire Bill Gates of Microsoft, who wants us to eat lab-grown butter that actually eliminates cows from the process. I'm not up for that. But they want to make it because Bill Gates says it'll save the planet, because it reduces the amount of carbon that's impacting on all of us. And that's his belief. Well, I don't buy into the global warming nonsense. I mean, do I think the globe is getting warmer? Absolutely it is. Is it being caused by human beings or the effects of our industry or agriculture? I don't believe so. But there's this company called Savor, S-A-V-O-R. Not that I'm interested in promoting it, but what they've said is we're going to create dairy-free alternatives to ice cream, cheese, and milk by using a, doesn't this sound delicious, thermochemical process that allows it to build fat molecules, create chains of carbon dioxide, hydrogen, and oxygen. The company has now announced an animal-free butter alternative, and here's Gates himself talking about it.
That's great. Agricultural emissions are one of the most difficult to get rid of. People have come up with alternative food, but what we're seeing is that it's hard to get more than a small market share. And those foods just don't taste the same. Savor's made an advance in the chemistry. It's ultra different in terms of the environmental footprint, but it's as good as those real animal fats.
Yeah, it's just as good, says Bill Gates, the guy who I swear this guy wants us to be eating bugs and everything else. I'm not buying into any of it. And frankly, I'd like to know, did the FDA actually approve him to make basically butter out of chemicals? And they say it would come in at less than 0.8 grams of CO2 equivalent per calorie. They said the standard climate footprint of real unsalted butter is about 2.4 grams per CO2 equivalent. So you can believe that you're eating it and saving the planet. Here calls now. Let me start with Gordon, who's a naysayer. Gordon, you know how much we love naysayers on this program, so thanks for calling. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
I highly resemble this comment you made about the paddle boarders, because I'm a boat captain of 24 tons, and if some paddle boarder goes out, it's a boat. If they go right in front of you, they're going to sue you in a New York second.
And let me ask you something. Have you ever had that happen? Because I know the rules on the water, and the rules on the water are if you're driving a 24-ton boat, and it is, so that's, you know, 48,000 pounds. If you're constrained by the channel, the paddle boarder is supposed to stay out of your way, and the collision is the responsibility of both parties. But have you ever seen such a lawsuit? Because I've never heard of one.
No, because I answer your questions honestly, but I almost ran over a little gal in the breakwater, within the breakwater in Seattle, because Grandpa decided to throw her on one of these little paddle boards, and I'm in my sailboat, to 24-foot sailboat, and easily lawsuit. Like,
well,
dangerous.
Easy potential lawsuit, depending on whose rules the road.
It matters if somebody gets killed. That's what
I understand.
Matters.
I don't want anybody killed either. But what's your solution to it? Do you think that having a state decide that they're going to charge a permit and make you put a license on that paddleboard is going to keep dimwit paddleboarders from going in front of you?
Yes, because it's water safety rules. It makes you go through the water safety.
The fact that you're wearing a sticker on your boat is going to make you more cognizant of the rules?
It's proof that you went through a class. Even if it's an online class, you go through the class. It takes 2 hours. You answer the questions, and you're going to save a lot of liability on both parties and a lot of legal junk.
I'm not sure I buy that argument, but Gordon, it's an interesting naysayer call. Frankly, there are lots and lots of people on the road who are idiot drivers, and every last one of them has gone through at least through the driver test. I mean, to get a driver's license, you've got to take a written test, you've got to take a driving test, and you still end up with idiots on the road. So I'm not sure how charging paddleboarders $20 to have a permit to be able to take a paddleboard out on the water is going to make the water a whole lot safer. In any case, let me get back to the butter, and I'll take your calls at 866-A-LARS. I mean, if Gordon's right, then all we have to do is make sure that everybody pays a fee and takes a test, and all of a sudden we'll be able to drive idiocy away. I mean, maybe that would work for the young ladies in Congress, you know, like AOC, Rashida Tlaib and the like, or Jasmine Crockett out of Texas. If we just made them take a test, do you think that would necessarily mean that they wouldn't go to Congress and act like idiots? But let me tell you this, the program I was mentioning, that Bill Gates is getting behind, this company called Savor that is now making lab-grown butter. And he claims, oh, it tastes great. She says, we are currently pre-commercial and working through regulatory approval to be able to sell our butter. We are not expecting to be able to move forward with any kind of sales until at least late 2025, so late this year. I guess my question would be, what is it are you trying to achieve by doing this? Are you simply trying to drive human beings away from using animals as a source of food? And I think that is the real agenda, which seems kind of strange because Gates is notorious that his investment fund owns a huge amount of land, agricultural land, in the United States. So if he owns this agricultural land, why is he trying to convince us to get butter that is made from chemicals in a laboratory? Now, meat and dairy alternatives have become popular, but as Gates points out, they have fallen short in terms of flavor. People have decided they don't like them. And in fact, the meatless hamburger, for example, seems like a great example of that, where you end up with people saying, oh yeah, I want one of those veggie burgers, only I've found out it doesn't taste like a hamburger. It doesn't taste very good. It doesn't have good texture. But they keep trying to find ways to do this. So what Gates wrote in terms of describing it is, the idea of switching to lab-made fats and oils may seem strange at first, but their potential to significantly reduce our carbon footprint is immense. By harnessing proven technology and processes, we may get one step closer to achieving our climate goals. Do you know what I would suggest for Mr. Gates? Gates flies around on a private jet. Give up the private jet, Bill Gates. You don't need the private jet. You can get just about anywhere you're going without owning a helicopter or a private jet or anything else. And in fact, why don't you downsize your houses? I mean, some of your houses cost tens of millions of dollars. They're very high technology, but I'm willing to bet that they burn up an awful lot of electricity. And of course, your primary invention, the thing that made you all those billions of dollars, well, that thing burns a lot of energy as well, and brought us server farms that are chewing up immense amounts of electricity. Let's go to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, what do you say about those paddleboard rules?
So, Lars, your last caller was incorrect. So the registration that we're referring to is on the flotation device itself, whether it's a boat or a paddleboard. That's just a tax, just like a car registration is. The other is a boater's license, and they both don't have anything to do with each other. You have to have a boater's license to operate something, but that doesn't mean that if the flotation device or the boat is tagged, that doesn't mean that the operator is certified.
No, and let me ask you this real quick. Is there any indication that having one of those licenses makes you a sensible boater?
Oh, no, I've been on the water so many times with, jet skis, boat operators. It does not create common sense.
The Lars Larson Show. You know, if we keep meeting like this, people are going to talk. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I guess I shouldn't get my hopes up too high that House Oversight Committee Chair James Comer is again promising to expose the Biden crime family. But this isn't his first go around. So I thought we'd talk about it with Leslie Corbley, who is an attorney and the author of Progressive Prejudice, Exposing the Devouring Mother. Leslie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks much for having me.
Hey, so tell me this. I am very much in favor of finding out the Biden crime family and every one of the scams that they ran. But when James Comer comes out and says, and I think he's right, I'm not a lawyer, it sounds like you are an attorney, but when he says We're not even sure it's legal to use an auto pen on a legal document. But it's what's not questionable is that the president of the United States, Joe Biden in this case, had no idea what was being signed using the auto pen in his name. We know that to a fair certainty right now, don't we?
Sure. I mean, I think one could certainly, I think it's highly unlikely that Joe Biden was aware of what he was signing with the auto pen, based on what we know and just based on looking at his cognitive capacities, you know, particularly towards the end of when he was in office. The difficulty, of course, comes in the fact that I'm aware of this is pretty precedent setting as far as I don't know of a precedent of something similar like this having happened in American history. It seems like we're in this climate now where each party, you know, when they're getting into office, there's an increasing desire to look at the prior administration, right, for corruption. Yep. And whatnot. And that's completely understandable, right? That's the climate we're in now. And I think this speaks volumes to where we're kind of heading in the future as far as increasing scrutiny that will be applied to the prior administration when there's a change from a Republican to Democrat.
Although that's a new phenomenon, isn't it? Because in the past, mm-hmm. I know it confused and angered, I think, a lot of people like me who said, why are you saying you're not going to go after the crimes of the last administration? They say, oh, you know, this is how D.C. works. We move on and we don't bother them. And then when we end up leaving office, our successors do not come back and beleaguer us. I don't think that's the way it should be. I think they ought to say, hey, if crimes were committed, if the law was broken by the prior administration, we're going to go after them. Wouldn't Americans expect that?
I think they would, and I think what this whole dynamic is really revealing is the underlying instability in our system, right? So we have the Constitution. We say we live in a republic under the Constitution, but the reality is actually quite a bit different. It's more like what you described above, right? There's a certain, like, class of Americans, so to speak, where the crimes they committed while in office are kind of, you know, there's a blind eye that was always turned, right? And I think the bigger the bureaucracy has become, the more government there is at the federal level, the more you see that kind of, you know, mindset, because that's how bureaucracies tend to work. And so again, I think that this dynamic now is revealing how unstable our current system actually is in reality, because you have a lot more polarization and a lot more politicization of every issue kind of under the sun. So it shouldn't come as any shock that there's now this appetite for each party to kind of engage in that kind of retrospective political warfare in some ways is a good way to put it, but it drives their bases, right? It drives each both Republican and Democratic Party bases. And it should, obviously, the focal point should be on whether crimes were committed. But I think where the Democrats in particular are going to be weak on this issue is that they spent so much political capital going after Donald Trump for corruption. And so, you know, the more that the corruption of the Democrats is revealed, the less they have to distinguish themselves on, because they kind of were claiming the moral high ground for well over a decade. And I think that's crumbling underneath them. And it's going to become a real struggle. Now, again, whether James Comer comes through or not remains to be seen. It certainly would be a pretty big precedent-setting, I suppose, case if he did. But, again, I think this reveals a broader dynamic in American political and social culture. And it also, like I said, I think reveals how unstable our current system actually is and how much corruption is going on behind the scenes.
Well, and Leslie, by the way, is the author of Progressive Prejudice, Exposing the Devouring Mother. And I'm going to have to ask you about that in a moment because I'm just curious. But here's the thing that bothers me. If you have a child who goes out, whether the child is 6 or 16, and they get away with something and there is no punishment for it, then the next time they're likely to do it again. So if you tell politicians, you can go to Washington, D.C., you can try all kinds of dirty tricks, and it won't matter because the next administration will not come after you like you didn't come after them, then you've set up a dynamic of the elites where they get to break all the rules because they know they're never called to justice. Does Donald Trump change that equation now?
I don't know. I want to say I hope so. I mean, it would be fantastic if that dynamic were to change. But the problem is that the more the bureaucracy has grown, and our bureaucracy is nowhere near as small as it was at the founding of the country, you know, the Republican system of government that was set up under the U.S. Constitution was designed where the voters are the ones holding politicians accountable. That mechanism is, in my opinion, broken. It's very, very difficult for voters in 21st century America to actually hold D.C. accountable, because it's huge, right? It's kind of beyond the ability of voters to hold them accountable. I think that's one of the problems we're dealing with, right? The public is really frustrated by the degree of corruption, but the public's ability to vote for some kind of accountability is weakened. So, again, I certainly hope Donald Trump can make inroads in that. I think that would be fantastic. But the reality is the way the system is currently set up, it makes it really difficult for voters to actually hold politicians accountable.
Well, Leslie, tell me this. What is progressive prejudice? I think I can imagine what it is, but I want to know what it amounts to.
Sure. So I titled the book Progressive Prejudice because I think that there's a lack of discussion and discourse in our nation regarding what it looks like to fall on the margins of progressive culture. I think progressives have this idea that they're sort of by nature anti-authoritarian, they're tolerant, they're kind, they're loving, and there's not really a lot of discourse about what it looks like for those who actually are marginalized or harmed by progressive worldviews. And so the book is actually a part autobiography and also part cultural commentary that goes through sort of my own life, and I very much felt I was on the margins of a progressive worldview, and I think there's just not a lot of discourse surrounding what it looks like for people who kind of feel as if they're outcast by progressives.
Well, and in fact, we get pushed to the margins by a lot of the progressives. What is the devouring mother?
Sure. So the devouring mother is essentially the archetype of female predation, right? So we talk a lot about toxic masculinity and culture now, but there's not really a lot of discussion of what it looks like when nurturing and caretaking is actually perverted. And so I'm not sure if you're familiar with the term Munchausen by proxy, but that's actually a clinical term for a woman. Well, it's almost always a mother, like 90%+ of cases are women.
Oh, Munchausen's?
Yes. And so, so that term is used as it's when a woman essentially makes a fictitious disorder for her child or someone in her care, and then medicates that child. So now, if you take that structure and remove the medical element, you can make that an emotionalized dynamic. It can do an equal, if not greater amount of harm to the child, right? So, because again, the woman in that case is actually perverting caretaking. Rather than taking care of the child, she's feeding her own narcissistic ego to some degree to as the caretaker. And that's what I would analogize to some degree the Democratic Party to right now is this. They talk a lot about being bleeding hearts and caring about the marginalized, but from a functional standpoint, a lot of that's indistinguishable from wanting those that are marginalized to be kind of perpetual victims, right?
Yeah.
Kind of
this constant, I mean, like this is our current victim class. We can take people of color, and now I think their new victim class is illegal aliens. And you say, this is our new class, and they will remember us at election time. They'll cast votes for us. They'll be loyal to us, and we will take care of them until we get tired of them and cast them aside and move on to the next marginalized group. That is Leslie Corbly, who is author of Progressive Prejudice, Exposing the Devouring Mother. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our poll on X. Hey, you know.
He's the best investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to be taking your phone calls and emails. I got to talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and if you aren't familiar with those, they are the federal mortgage agencies. They are controlled by the government. They are not entirely government agencies. They are not entirely private. But for a long time, I've been suggesting that maybe this is one of the things that Donald Trump could do to help to change the mortgage picture in America. Now, is that because I'm shopping for a mortgage? I am not. Would I like to see America get to some lower mortgage rates? I'll remind you that the day that Joe Biden took office, the mortgage rate in America, the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, was about 2.5%. It is now above 6%, although it's come down a little bit. It had actually touched 7% during the sad years of Joe Biden's presidency. But imagine this. Donald Trump is now doing this, not because I suggested it, but he has floated a plan to sell shares of both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, that would get the federal government out of owning, effectively owning the shares in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But if they did that, would it actually sort of privatize what goes on when it comes to mortgages? I don't want the government to be involved in mortgages. And I think one of the primary reasons that the government is involved in mortgages is because it's another opportunity to provide subsidies of one kind or another. I want to get to the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to take your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. And we talk about the issues of the day. We make this the best conversation in talk journalism. This segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. So why would I care? Why would I give a darn about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Because when the government is involved in something, whether it's the Federal Reserve, whether it's government regulators, they usually end up creating more problems than they solve. And as Seton Motley points out, as the 2008 financial crisis reminded Americans, permitting Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to generate private profits, but requiring taxpayers to foot the bill anytime a mortgage went wrong, it defaulted, is a recipe for an expensive financial disaster. In other words, if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were private entities altogether, if you got the federal government out of owning shares in them, if you got the federal government out of subsidizing them and being the backstop guarantee, then whoever it is that owns those entities, if you write bad mortgages, you get to pay the freight. If you write good mortgages, maybe you'll even make a profit. But as he points out, the implicit guarantee encourages more high-risk lending. It's a heads-I-win, tails-the-taxpayers-lose kind of contradiction. It inflates demand for mortgages with high default rates and makes another housing market crash and a financial crisis more likely. Let me offer you my translation of that. What it means is, if you say, well, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac make it easier to borrow money to buy a house. Well, I'd like to see every American get the opportunity to buy a house. But by, if you mean by easy, you say the interest rate will be lower, then it means you're going to attract people to take out loans that at some point they won't be able to pay back. And if you say, and if you can't pay them back, why, the taxpayers will be glad to make up for the losses. The American Enterprise Institute estimates that the mortgage subsidies raise interest rates on the federal debt by 10 to 15 basis points and add about $29 to $43 billion to federal spending. Now, why would that happen? Because if you go out and encourage people to borrow money to buy houses that they ultimately can't afford and they default on the mortgage, then that raises the cost of borrowing money. When the federal government is borrowing a gigantic amount of money, more than $30 trillion, and about a third of that rolls over every year, every couple of years, which means every 2 years, if you have some paper that rolls over, it means you're borrowing at one percentage point now. 2 years from now, you'll have to refinance that. And in the last few years, you've had to refinance it at a much higher rate. That ends up costing a lot of money. Privatizing Fannie and Freddie is the right way to do it, but only if the government says, and the ultimate backer of these mortgages is not going to be the American taxpayer. It is going to be whoever decides to invest in them. And if you say, well, we won't be able to get anybody to do that. Yes, you will. Believe me, there are plenty of investments out there that are high risk and high return. And people go out and they put money into them because they understand if you're going to get a high return, you have to have a high risk that goes with it. If you have a low risk, then it's likely to be a low return. So there will be private investors who will decide, I want to make big money. I mean, there are plenty of financial arrangements like that. There are people who buy bad loans. They buy them from the banks. They buy them from consumer credit organizations like the credit card companies because they know if I can buy $1 million worth of loans for $50,000, if I only manage to squeeze out $100,000 out of the $1 million that's owed, if they can get that money paid back, then guess what? They just doubled their money. That's a high return. Along with the high return comes a high risk as well. And if you decide you don't want to have a high-risk loan, then don't make high-risk loans. When you go out and encourage Americans to borrow money, I know, it's ultimately them signing on the bottom line. But if they're only signing because taxpayers have agreed to be the co-signer on that loan, only the co-signers never get paid off. They just end up paying the bill when somebody goes south on that loan. Glad to be with you on a Monday. It's the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.